when you go into exhibitions or competitions in the fine arts, fiber art is usually not there or is not accepted, or people don't gravitate towards that. They look for, you know, the usual painting, sculpture, that type of thing. And I wanted to go into that field. I didn't want to compete with other fiber artists because that's just what people usually do. And I said, but you know what? Fiber arts is art. You can look at my work and you can think photography. You can think painting. You can think the way things are put together. You can think of colors. You can think of whatever, but it's still art. And so what I did was I wanted to be more competitive. I compete with painters. I wanted to compete with sculptors. And so I've just been very fortunate. I just really have that they've accepted my work in that way. And that's why I think there's so many exhibitions, because I think people are now looking at things differently. Don't get me wrong, there's still a hierarchy of painting is up here, sculpture is not, but there's got to be a time, you know, and so I want to take advantage of that time. And so, again, I think it's all about fate. It's all about timing. And I'm just soaking it all in, and I'm just saying, you know what, it's my time. And I'm going
to
soak it.
Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive into the minds shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe that innovation happens in all aspects of life. I am your host, Dr. Yolanda Sanders. Today, we're joined by Vince Cavedo, an exceptional figure in the world of fashion design and fiber arts. Vince has not only made his mark through his innovative designs, but also through his inspiring journey of resilience and dedication. As an international award-winning designer, author, and professor, Vince brings a wealth of experience and creativity to the table. He is a pioneer in the industry, known for his boundary-pushing wearable art and his ability to integrate traditional and new technologies into his designs. Vince's journey of fashion design began after earning his Bachelor's of Science degree in Clothing and Textiles and his Master's of Science in Workforce Education and Development from Southern Illinois University, followed by a Master's of Fine Arts in Textiles and Fibers from the University of Nebraska. His competitive spirit, nurtured from years of an elite gymnast under the coaching of his mother, an Olympic gymnast coach, has propelled him to the forefront of fashion design competitions worldwide. In addition to his professional accomplishments, Vince has a profound personal story of battling and surviving non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. His experience deepened his commitment to helping others, particularly through supporting diversity in fashion education. Currently, as an associate professor at Kent State University's School of Fashion, Vince inspires students and colleagues. So listeners, please join me in welcoming Vince Cavedo to the Innovation Insights podcast. We're set for a conversation that's sure to be both enlightening and engaging. Vince, thank you for joining us today.
Hello.
It's so great to have you here. We have known each other and have been friends for 25. I probably shouldn't put a number out there, should I?
Since the 90s.
Since the 90s, which was a great time.
It was.
I will tell you this. I do not, when I was teaching, I told my students that the 90s was not a historical time period. Because that's when I was in college in my heydays. We don't consider the 90s that long ago. Or I'm delusional. Well, Vince, you just have always made me smile. Your positivity, your warm and your just sheer talent as a designer. And would you talk to us about your background and how being an elite gymnast, because you're probably the only elite gymnast that I know that is a faculty member in our discipline. Could you talk about how that life really informed your work in fashion design and teaching?
Sure. When your mother was an Olympic coach, your family gets very involved. Now, it's funny because both my parents were professors. My mother did coach at the college level, and she taught phys ed. And my dad taught physics. And both are very, very into education, and that was very important. And so was gymnastics. Now, it's funny because I hated gymnastics when I was a little kid. I really did. And it wasn't until I was in high school that I got started. And so I was a late bloomer, but all of us in the family, there were five kids, three older sisters and a younger brother, were all involved in gymnastics, whether we competed or my three older sisters, after they did gymnastics, opened up, two of them opened up gymnastics schools, and I taught in them also. And being competitive was very important. And having Asian parents who are very into education really instilled in us how important it was that we had education and that we had college education and that it was going to carry us far into our future. Now, of course, I didn't believe that when I was a little kid. I didn't want to go to college, believe it or not. I wanted to be an artist, and I thought, I'll be a starving artist. My dad said, by hook or by crook, you are doing college. And I didn't have a choice. And in gymnastics, and my parents, they felt that you had to get first place because second place was first place loser. Terrible. But the pressure was in the 70s, being one of very small number of Asians and Filipinos, especially Filipinos, in the area I grew up in, the Midwest. I grew up in Bloomington, Illinois. The Vietnam War was new still. And so being Asian was not really very acceptable. And so it was very difficult. And so it was instilled in us that we had to do better, because that was the only way we were going to get accepted. And so in gymnastics and everything I did, I really did do my best. And trying to please your parents, now I'm sure you remember how hard you had to work to please your parents. And that's what I did. And so I did a lot of contests, actually, you name it, art contests, dance contests, you name it, I did it, trying to please my parents. And so in gymnastics and fashion were really, they shared the same journey, because you have to come up with, you have to be competitive, you have to be innovative, and you have to be true to yourself. And you have to give judges and you have to give consumers a product that they can relate to, that they felt was unique to you and that was sellable. And so that was what made me, I think, a good match to being in fashion, because I'm very competitive, even today. Now, being competitive it has changed throughout the years, but in most cases, I am much more competitive with myself, because that's who I have to answer to. And so as time went on, that was who I had to plead, because I have to live by myself. I had to live with myself. So gymnastics and fashion really are very alike in many ways.
Very interesting. And also what's interesting is that you didn't start gymnastics competitively until you said high school, correct?
Yeah. Late.
Well, yeah. And many times we have students that decide that they want to become fashion designers a little bit later. High school is still early in life, but I guess I'm really contemplating, you know, how did you approach that? Because there's skill building in both areas. And how did you approach building those skills? Or did you feel like you had natural talent?
I think that I was very fortunate because we had our own gymnastics school. And so I was there every day. And my parents felt that if the kids were involved, us kids in family, if we were involved in gymnastics, that would keep us out of trouble. And it did, because we were so involved in the business. And I think that I also had the natural ability. I think my family just did. I was a very small person. And so gymnastics is built for small people. And so it really did help to have that. Now, my mother, who was into gymnastics, of course, got my dad involved because he's into physics. And so what he did was he would videotape me or the other gymnasts, and he would say, if you hit this angle, if you hit this angle. And so I was not a very strong, physically strong gymnast. And so I had to rely heavily on technique. And so how I did things had to be technically correct so that I was able to perform them.
Wow. Wow. That is amazing. And I love the integration of the scientific technical aspect of it and describing that and integrating that, because oftentimes the sciences are put off in another area and talk about it within athletics. And I know that your work as a designer, you also deal with sciences with that, dye techniques and all of that, which we'll talk about later on. Well, just fascinating. You've also been very open about your battle with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I recall as you were going through that. So how has that influenced you and your life?
Oh my gosh, it has probably one of the most major influential occurrences that has happened to me, because it came as a surprise. I discovered it by accident. And throughout my battle with cancer, because it's years, it wasn't just one event that happened in a period of time. It was a long years of having to deal with not only the physical changes that I had to go through and the surgeries that I went through, but the psychological aspect of having to go through something so traumatic. And so what it taught me was that life is short and you can only do so much in that time. And as I get close, and I'm very close to retirement, time is much more important to me. And so what I want to be able to share with people in regards to my experience with cancer is that do the best you can with what you have. And I want to share that with people and to not waste your time with stuff that doesn't really matter. And that was one thing that I really learned, was there are things that you just have to tune out because it doesn't matter. So that's what I want to instill in people. If they get anything from me, that's one thing that I want. To enjoy life. You know, life is so good. And I want them to know that it is good. Yes.
Oh, that's a great message to people. And I hope our listeners truly take that to heart. And as a designer, I know that you've integrated that into your processes, because there's your design. So again, they just make me smile. I have some favorites and you can tell that there's joy in what you're doing. So would you talk with us about your design process and how do you approach designs and materials too?
Sure. I was trained actually, you know, in the beginning to design for the masses. And as time went on, I had to respond to my needs. And because I went through so much that it affected me. And so I had to respond to those feelings, to what I was going through. And so it became very personal and very artistic. And so my travel through the fashion experience has been very positive, because I did think about the masses. When, of course, I have to when I teach my students, because that's what they're going to be going into. But I also tell them that, you know, what makes you different from another designer? What makes you unique? What is your niche? And I think that's important that they be able to identify that. And to be able to do that, you have to put yourself into it. And my work evolved to something more personal. And because I needed to invest in myself. And I want students to really look into themselves. Because if you take a look at great designers, you can tell their work because they put themselves into it. And I think that's what makes good designers and good artists. And you know what? It makes good people. And I think that's important.
Thank you for just dropping all of these wonderful nuggets for our guests. Talking a little bit more about your work, you work in both 3D forms for the body, but also two-dimensional forms in the area of quilts. Do you approach those processes differently?
Actually, no. My process is the same. Usually, I this can sound strange, but a lot of my ideas come from dreams, conversations, what's going on around me. Lately, it's been the social upheaval thing. Like the pandemic was a real big issue that I had to face. And what I would do is I would translate those ideas into something that is possible within my skill level, my technique, and be able to spell out what I want to say. And I think those are really important for me to be able to do. And so after I think about what I want to do, I have to make sure that it's possible, that it can be something tangible. And yeah, so I go off with whatever is in my head. And usually when I think of an idea, it translates into something visual. And it's funny because I have a notebook right beside my bed, because you never remember your dream in the morning. So, you know, you wake up, I just write them down.
That is such a wise piece of advice to people that have the notebook by, because you know, many people do not remember.
Yeah. And one of the things too, I especially tell my students is that I tell them to avoid looking at fashion magazines and things like that. And to look at art, to look at nature. And, you know, like, for example, students have a hard time putting colors together. And so they look at color forecasting. They look at fashion they look at all that stuff. And I said, it's much easier than that. Look at your aquarium. Look at the fish. And look at the colors they have. And there's your color combinations. Nature has everything.
Yes, it does. And some beautiful color combinations.
Yes.
Oh, well, I wanted to talk about your materials, because over the years, you have approached the materials that you used in a variety of ways, and sustainability, I know, has also been an important part of your approach, too.
Yeah, I make sure that whatever I use is something that is available to my students. Even the dyeing process. Now, a lot of fiber artists are going to kill me when I say this, but I do die with Rit Dye. Why? Because that is what's available to my students. And they're not afraid of it. So I just have to show them how to use it correctly. And I've never had issues with fading. I've never had issues with getting the colors I want. And it has to be possible. Because if it's impossible, then my students aren't going to learn. So it's important for me to be able to give them information that is applicable to the projects that they're doing and that it's available. That's very important. I also don't use fancy, expensive fabric because my students can't afford $25, $50 a yard fabric. What can they afford? They can afford what is available at Joann Fabrics, or they can afford what is available at Walmart. And so that's what I do. And a lot of my projects, believe it or not, are things that I find at Walmart at $1 or $2 a yard, because that is what's available. And no, I don't even remember the last time I went to a fabric store. And I don't go to Walmart anymore. So I've been going to thrift stores because that's one way of saving planet. But did you know that the majority of people that donate to the thrift store, most of that goes into the waste? And I didn't know. But it's one way of trying to help with trying to save the planet. And so now I use old garments, I use sheets, curtains, whatever is available to me.
And, you know, that's such a wonderful message to give to your students and to any artist, is that you don't have to go out there and buy the most expensive materials. You can source inexpensively. You can also reuse sheets and curtains. Oh my gosh, there's so much yardage.
Yes.
So many fabric things.
And you know, what is the challenge in working with a $50, $75 yard fabric? It's beautiful fabric to begin with. But yeah, there's not really much of a challenge, but I think a bigger challenge is if you can come up with a dollar yard fabric and make it look fabulous, right? I mean, that's what we're here for, is to help educate and help them do the best with what they have. And I think that's important.
Well, that is innovation. I love it. That is absolutely innovation. Oh, over the years, you've had your own design companies, your fashion label, Vinci. Could you talk about how that was established and how it evolved and how it reflects your own design philosophy, too.
Sure. When I graduated from college, day after graduation, actually, and this is a true story, I went to the office at school, and there was two women there looking for designers. They wanted to hire a designer, and there I was. And so I also had my portfolio with me. So it was like, what is going on? And so I was hired immediately to do their collection. They only did one collection a year because their customer was in somewhere in the Caribbean. That's where their stores were. And their company was based in St. Louis. I was in Carbondale, Illinois. It was only an hour and a half away. So it's very convenient. And so I learned a lot. And then I moved to San Francisco, where I became an assistant designer to David Ravel. And I really learned a lot. But what I learned the most was that there were hundreds of designers in the San Francisco Bay Area. And they all belonged in this one group that I joined. And they were so inspiring that I literally did quit my job to start my own label, because one thing I did learn from working for a company is that you don't really have freedom to design what you want unless you're a perfect match. And so I was designing things that, you know, that you probably would not design, but it was a very important lesson that I had to go through. And so starting up my own label, Vinci is my nickname because my dad has the same name. And so I'm Vinci. And so I did a contemporary men's and women's label. And then after San Francisco, I moved back to Illinois and I started to teach in Carbondale. And but I missed the designing part and my gymnastics. And so I started up an athletic wear company where I designed and manufactured leotards, warm-up suits, t-shirts, you name it, anything athletic wear I did. And then after that, did Vinci when I came to Ohio. And then I stopped for a little bit and then restarted it not too long ago, actually in 2019. And I got involved with Columbus Fashion Week. And so got a lot of media attention that way. And it was a really good learning experience because I've been teaching. I'll be going into my 35th year of teaching. And I wanted to know what it was like again to be a designer because times have changed. But you know what? Really hasn't, because good design will live forever. But it was an experience that I had to relive again, to know what the demands of the industry are, what people are looking for. And so it was a really good professional development for me because I teach students that are going into design. I need to know what it's like to be a designer that they aspire to be. I think it's important that I do that. And so now I have real good connections with Ohio designers. Some have become really big and important. And so that's really good. Yeah, it was. But now my Vinci label is different. I don't really sell anything. What I do is I give my services for free. And what I do is if businesses want me to look at their collections, if they want me to give my input, I would do that. If there are groups, for example, Girl Scout groups or hospital groups that need sewing machine sergers or whatever, I will try to look for refurbished ones and provide it to them because what got me really started was when I was going through cancer, there was a group of women that put together cancer knitted. And so I thought, wow, that's a really good way of giving back. I'm really big into giving back because I have been so fortunate that I have to give back. And so that's just my way. And if students need a sewing machine, they know they can come to me and I'll provide it for them. Now, that is with partnership with Habitat for Humanity. They have stores that are called Reef Stores. And so what they do is they get a lot of sewing machines that they don't want to sell. And so what they do is they give it to me and I will refurbish it, get it fixed, get it done, get whatever I need to do. And so that's how I get my supplies from, so that I can give it for free. Because I wouldn't be able to afford it.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. There are two things that you mentioned here was professional development, continuing to learn. And you mentioned that you're in your 35th year of teaching, but you're a lifetime learner. What are your thoughts about that?
Oh, my gosh. You know, it's really interesting because the past 5 years, I've been preparing for retirement. I've been writing ideas of things that I want to do. I've been collecting things that I want to fix. I want to make. I want to do all that kind of stuff. And then I was thinking about 2 years ago, well, maybe I'll go back to school. Why not? You know, I don't have the pressures of having to perform a certain way, a certain level. I can just be a student. And so I would like to go in either into more art or into education.
I love it. I love it. I love it. That's the joy of being in academia and in education, is that it just continues to fuel your love learning.
Yeah.
Now, you also mentioned giving back and how that is one of your important values that you value. What are some, and you really described the innovative way of giving back by partnering with Habitat for Humanity. So could you just talk a little bit more about that so our listeners can have some ideas? It really relates to one of our latest newsletters for Innovation Insight, which is Innovative Servitude. And so this is so timely.
Yes, I have just been so fortunate in my career in academics that paying back is very important. One of the things that I've always done in the past 10 years is I belong to the International Textiles and Apparel Association, which is the premier organization for our field. And they have done so much for my career. It has been an amazing ride. And trying to help my colleagues that are just beginning in this field, I tell them, get involved. It doesn't have to be in the International Textiles Apparel Association. It could be any other professional organization that they can get involved in that will help them cater to their needs as an educator to become a better educator and to be connected with other academicians so that they can learn best practices in whether it's in teaching or in anything that has to do with what they do as researchers or as data people. And I think it's really important. And one of the things that I can do is to provide, for example, a scholarship to graduate students at ITAA, which I've done. And currently I'm sponsoring the Best in Show for faculty. And that has been very rewarding because the people that do creative work, I think it's much more difficult for them to find funding. And I know it was for me. And I am far from being a wealthy person, but I don't have kids. I have fur babies, you know, and they don't go to college. They don't need cars. And anyone can do it. And I would like to have people get more involved in doing that because it really doesn't take much to do that. I also do that. I've done it with the fashion school here at Penn, and I would like to go out into other design schools and be able to do that. It's not a lot, but it's what I can do. It's what I'm able to do. So why not?
Well, it's very gracious of you to provide the scholarships and the awards. And thank you. I am a member of ITAA and currently on the council, and we truly do appreciate that award. You have won the Best in Show many times within the design juried exhibition. And so it's just so lovely for you to sponsor that award.
Well, yeah, one thing that I want people to know is that all of the accolades that I've collected really isn't just by me. It is with the support of other people. And I think that it's important that people know that because, you know, without some of my colleagues, without some of my mentors, there's no way I could have done what I've accomplished. Without them, there's no Vince. There really isn't. And those people that have made a path for me, I have to pay back so that people can go that same route with their individuality and with their creativity, because that's what we need in this world, I think.
I agree with you. I so agree. So we need each other.
Yes.
We need each other. I want to talk about some of your exhibitions, especially the Fortuna exhibition that you had at the Kent State University Museum, which is just an amazingly beautiful facility to begin with. And your exhibit was a mixture of your theatrical costumes, your ready-to-wear garments, your quilt work. And what really inspired this theme for this exhibit?
Well, you know, one of the things that's really interesting is that students don't know what faculty do. They think that we teach all day long and that's it. And, you know, and that's not true. We have to go far and beyond the teaching realm. And because I'm getting close to retirement and I doubt I'll have another solo show, this was an opportunity to show my students what I've done so that they can look at my work. And when I do my work, I don't try to convince anyone anything. I'm really not. What I'm wanting to do is to provoke question. And so I want students to look at my work so that they can ask themselves, what was I thinking? Or how would they interpret what I was thinking? Or how would they interpret what they were thinking? So it's about asking questions and not answering. That's just how I think about my design, because it's not about me. It's about what people are looking at and what they're thinking about that I think is the most important thing. The Fortuna show was actually inspired by a song that was created in 1935, 1936 by Karl Orff, a German composer. And the song was really Carmina Burana, O Fortuna. And in short, it's O Fate. And I think that timing and a lot of design in fashion is about timing. You could be too early, too late. Time is just perfect. And it was just by fate, I think. And it was a year-long process to get the show going. So they built everything just for the show with lighting, turning tables. It was just amazing that the Fashion Museum here at Kent State is such an inspiration to go to. And you've seen it. You've been there. And it's just been an amazing teaching tool. And I think it was just fate that my show started at the Fashion Museum. And what I was really proud of was the director of the museum sent me this article. And the article was that my show was one of the top 10 exhibitions going on at that time. And I was like, but it's the pandemic. Nowadays, everything is online. There's a YouTube recording of me talking about my work and things like that. And so that's inspiring that with technology today, that things like that can happen. And so visitors, there wasn't a downturn with visitors because they visited online and was able to see the show. And the show was on for a year. And so I was very fortunate. That was my second show that I did here at Fashion Museum. So I was very fortunate.
What was your first show?
Oh my gosh. My first show was, I don't remember when, it was such a long time ago, 2010. I think it was 2010. And they had an opening at the museum because most of the time the museum is scheduled a year in advance. And mm-hmm. I don't know if someone canceled or whatever, but the school director at the time was J.R. Campbell. And he had suggested that I put on the show because I was a fairly new faculty at Kent at the time. And people really didn't know me. And it was a really good introduction for me. So, So that was a fun show. A lot of quilters came to see that show.
I'm sure it was so inspiring to the students and the surrounding community around Kent.
One thing that was interesting about that show is, you know, when you're at a museum, you're not supposed to touch anything, right? It was important for me that people were able to touch. The museum did not like that. But what we did was we had samples of the fabric. So they could look at it, they could feel it, because there were a lot of things that I melted fabric, and people were always wanting to touch it, and we had samples available. Yeah. That wasn't my so came up with that idea. Because I said, let's touch the direct.
So touch panels for people. Oh, that's fabulous. That's fabulous. Again, more innovation. Now, you have quite the exhibition track record. And as we were speaking in preparation for this podcast, you discussed multiple projects that you have going on, multiple exhibitions. And many people don't really understand or realize the management and the project management that a designer or artist must go through to prepare for exhibitions, to get work to exhibitions. And so would you talk a little bit about that and some strategies? Because I think this would be a whole new realization for individuals that, oh, designers and artists are project managers too.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I profess that I have ADHD and that I really do. And I have to be busy all the time. My hands have to be moving all the time. And so I have projects galore. And I can't just work on one project. I have to work on several. But I'm also the type of person that it has to get finished. And so I'm lucky in that way that I'm able to do that. Now, with that said, I am very unorganized, just being honest. I'm just very unorganized. And so unless I am given a deadline, I'm no good. So I have posted, like right now, if you can see my office, there are notes everywhere. Because that's the only way I can stay organized, and I have it on my iPhone. Also, today I'm meeting with, Yolanda, and then after this, I have a meeting with somebody. So, it's things like that keep me organized, but naturally, I am not a very organized person, but thank goodness whoever invented Post-it notes, that is what keeps me going. And because I'm very... like I said before, I'm very competitive, and that also keeps me going. And so all these competitions, 30 so far this year, which is crazy. That is like the most I've ever done, has been very, school is out. I've been here every day, including weekends, because that's the kind of time you have to put in to get things done. And so I think that my competitiveness has kept me, I guess I'm more organized than I thought, because my competitive keeps me in line, because your things have to get to a certain place. It's going to be a lot cheaper if you send it way ahead of time the next day. And so that's just what you have to do. Now, I wish I had someone to help me, but that's not going to happen.
Well, and that's very true. I mean, for faculty members who are managing shipping work to exhibitions, making sure it gets back, and that is a whole other layer on top of the other work project. So it's not just producing the work and miraculously it ends up in an exhibit. And you have to think about how is it going to be installed in the exhibit, send those directions.
And what exhibit to put it in. You can't just put it in anything. So it's really important that it reflects your values. It reflects the kinds of things that you do, the things that you want to be associated with. Those are really very important also.
Thank you for sharing all of that, because there is this really so much more work to getting work prepared for exhibitions and juried exhibitions. Unlike publishing a paper, you go through that submission process and the edits and things like that, but you don't have to track that the paper is delivered back to you and pay for the paper to be shipped back and to make sure it comes back in the right condition.
I think people that are in academics, and I don't think I'm any different than anyone else, But there is a certain level of acceptance and excellence that you want to meet for yourself. And sometimes it just doesn't happen and you have to start all over again. Like the two, and I don't know if you can see the purple thing back there and this red thing. I started with this red thing and it took forever because each circle has to be cut and has to be sewn around and then you have to sew it together. Anyway, it took 3 weeks just to put it together. And I thought that I was using cotton wrap polyester thread. And I wasn't. I was using polyester thread. And so it didn't die. And so you can see the thread. And I was like, oh my gosh. And then my colleague said, but it's beautiful. It looks good. I go, I can't. No, I can't. I just can't live with that. Knowing that will bother me. And so I did the purple one, making sure everything was dyeable and all that kind of stuff. But I don't think I could have lived with myself knowing that there was no way I would show it to begin with because it would just bother me. But there are people like myself, they know that sentence isn't correct or that paragraph needs to be changed. Or, you know it, but it needs to be edited. It needs to be whatever. And it's really, really important because it reflects who you are.
Absolutely. We talk a lot about personal branding at Innovation Insights, and that is part of your brand. And as a designer, your brand is so tangible and visible. So, that makes absolute sense. That makes absolute sense. Wow. Good luck with 30-some exhibitions this year. Wow. And we're not even 6 months into the year.
So I know. I'm expecting something every month until August. And then I'm starting on new projects now. And this time, though, I will be working. I'll be collaborating with a colleague of mine. And that has been so helpful. Because there were a couple of designs, for example, that was going through my head. And I said, Dr. Wong, this Dr. Jiayang Wong, and I said, I'm stuck. I am so stuck. I can't do it anymore. I was really wanting to give up. And she said, have you thought of? And I go, no. And it was, it's been great working with her. And we have several projects that we're working on for exhibitions in 2025. I go on sabbatical this fall, and she's on sabbatical for the whole year. We'll be very busy working together.
Oh, my goodness. I can't wait to see what the two of you come up with. Wow. Wow. What a great team there.
I'm very fortunate.
You have a great group of people in the fashion school. I'm a big fan. So you've also mentioned the importance of diversity and fostering it. You've talked about through scholarships. Why is diversity important to you? And yes, I said the D word, which I know many times we can't say diversity now. Or the D word.
Diversity. Which I think is a shame.
I do too. So I just keep saying diversity.
Yeah. Yes. And inclusivity.
Equity.
Equity. Yes.
Ability.
Yeah. And
community.
It's very important to be in a community, especially in higher education, to be in a community that is inclusive and diverse. Because if everything is coming from one perspective, how do you grow? And that's why I think diversity is very important, not only culturally, ethnically, but a way of thinking, a way of presenting, a way of talking, and a way of connecting with people. And I think that if you have more diversity, your students are going to get so much more from their education. So I think it's very important that we push that. No matter how many people try to push back, I'm just not one to waver. because it's that important.
Thank you. Thank you for all the work that you do in that area and continuing to push forward. Well, you've talked about some new projects that you're working on. Can you share with us some about the new projects and new design methods or technology that you're excited to explore in the next 10 years?
So I did a big 180. I did a big turnaround. And again, and you're making me think of this now because I don't usually think that hard about where I came from. I do, but being competitive is what I meant. It's like I like being very competitive. And in the field of fiber arts, there's not very many opportunities. And when you go into exhibitions or competitions in the fine arts, fiber art is usually not there or is not accepted, or people don't gravitate towards that. They look for, you know, the usual painting, sculpture, that type of thing. And I wanted to go into that field. I didn't want to compete with other fiber artists because that's just what people usually do. And I said, but you know what? Fiber arts is art. You can look at my work and you can think photography. You can think painting. You can think the way things are put together. You can think of colors. You can think of whatever, but it's still art. And so what I did was I wanted to be more competitive. I compete with painters. I wanted to compete with sculptors. And so I've just been very fortunate. I just really have that they've accepted my work in that way. And that's why I think there's so many exhibitions, because I think people are now looking at things differently. They, you know, don't get me wrong, there's still a hierarchy of painting is up here, sculpture is not, but there's got to be a time, you know, and so I want to take advantage of that time. And so, again, I think it's all about fate. It's all about timing. And I'm just soaking it all in. And I'm just saying, you know what, it's my time and I'm going to soak it all in.
Well, thank you for paving that way, because as you mentioned, the hierarchy within fine arts, and it's hard for fiber artists to exhibit in that area. So thank you for working to break those barriers. Really appreciate it. So our last question is, how do you define innovation?
Okay, I think innovation is a new way of thinking to me. It is looking at things from a different perspective. It doesn't have to be technology. It's just looking at it from a different point of view. And so when I talk to my students about being innovative, being creative, being unique, it's about looking at things from a different point of view. So I'll give them an example. I'll pick up an object, usually like my phone, and I'll say, pick up your phone, not to talk to it, not to look at it, not to look at the websites or anything, but just to look at it as an object. And what they'll do is they'll just pick up their phone and they'll just, and that's the way they look at it. I said, okay, that's the regular way. But have you ever tried looking at your phone from this way, or this way, or this, or this way? That's from a different point of view, a different perspective. And I think that, to me, is innovative. And so when I look at my designs and my work, I look at it, I try to look at things from a different point of view, because that's just the way I am. That's just the way I am naturally. I've never really looked at things straight on. I've always looked at it from somewhere else. And because it's natural to me, that's just what I do. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's just the way it's design thinking.
Oh, that's a wonderful answer. And your students are so lucky to have you to tell them to look at the world and the objects within it. It's from a different view. And just, you're just so inspirational. I'm wanting to go back and do some design work now after. Go out and look at nature or look at color. So your students are so blessed, Sam. They truly are.
Thank you.
And we are too today for having you on the podcast. And so I know that you're active on Facebook. Is that a great way for people to get in touch with you? And
yes, and I have a website also, yeah. VinciDesigns.artwork.com. Something like
that. Okay, but great.
Yeah.
Great. Well, we'll make sure that all that information is also put on the ender of the podcast.
Great.
You. Just thank you for being here. We so appreciate your insights, your knowledge, your enthusiasm. Vince, thank you for sharing your journey.
Thank you. Fun. This was fun.
Good. As you were talking about life is short and making choices, doing things that are fun. And this has just been a joy for me to talk with such inspiring individuals like yourself and friends that I've known for years.
Since
the 90s.
The good old days.
The good old days. Oh, I also thank you for your dedication to fashion and the commitment to your students and the next generation of designers. We truly appreciate all of this.
Thank you.
To our listeners, we hope that you found this conversation inspiring and enlightening as I did. For more information about Vince's work and recent projects, we will have that information at the end of the podcast. And just remember, you can revisit this episode and share it with others to be inspired, and also be our other episodes too of Innovation Insights Podcast. I am Dr. Yolanda Sanders. I'm signing off until next time. So keep innovating, keep dreaming, keep making a difference.